For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Governor Stitt signs legislation he originally vetoed. House Bill 2632 prohibits restrictions on a patient's right to choose a pharmacy provider without paying a penalty and calls for an advisory committee to review complaints and administer fines. Despite changes to the original, the state chamber still called for him to veto it. Neva, what was different this time?
Well, I think this is one of these fascinating bills. It's been around the legislature the last couple of sessions, didn't go anywhere. And then this session, basically the difference is that we had a successful mobilization and a grassroots campaign by the local pharmacy folks. And they really turned up the heat on these lawmakers. And so every good argument that was good argument being the argument that the folks that were trying to knock this down were making by the state chamber and many groups that typically Republicans particularly would be sensitive to or probably line up with didn't go anywhere. So it was interesting that there was not a single no vote. And I think that's where even if the governor had entertained the idea of wanting to veto this a second time, there was just no cover. I mean, when you have every single lawmaker saying, hey, this is okay, even though you have the argument being made, you had a House fiscal impact analysis basically showing that it would cost to the state would increase prescription drug costs, $7.2 million was the number that they gave, and that the regulation factor to be able to put this into place would be about $350,000 annually, and none of that seemed to make any difference at all. I mean, this was a case where you would hear lawmakers say, look, you know, the folks back home, this is the guy or the woman who puts the sign in their local pharmacy that says support me when election time comes up. Now they're saying call your legislator or your senator and tell them not to raise prescription costs. And that was kind of the argument that they were trying to put out there that got traction, and clearly lawmakers went full throttle behind.
Right.
Well, you know, it was a really simple message about a really complex subject matter, because the complex subject matter we're talking about here are pharmacy benefit managers. You know, these are the groups dominated by three big giants, you know, Optum Rx, Express Scripts, and CVS Caremark. And they really determine, you know, how and where people can get their pharmacy benefits and you know, how much it's going to cost. They negotiate deals. And the local pharmacists were really concerned that they were being left out of these deals, that they were being treated unfairly, that there's disparate treatment, that they wanted to be on equal footing with these big chain pharmacies that are showing up, you know, not just in even, you know, mid-sized cities, but I mean, in, you know, even small cities and small rural areas, you're seeing chain pharmacies come in and compete head-to-head with local pharmacists, and they often have an advantage, you know, just in terms of, you know, the scaling of the cost of running a pharmacy. And so, yeah, you had something that, you know, received zero no votes, unanimous support. And this is, I mean, if you think of, you know, interesting things about this, the chamber to be on the opposite, you know, the state chamber, a really powerful lobbying force at the state capitol, to be on the opposite side of a unanimous vote is pretty extraordinary. And I think that it speaks to the power of whenever you have local small businesses standing up and saying, we don't want these big companies to have a big competitive advantage against us. It was also a little ironic to hear the state chamber come out and say, well, you know, the state could subject itself to litigation if we pass this, because, you know, generally, you know, they're the group that's they don't worry about that so much. But here they pulled out all the stops, but they still couldn't get a single no vote. I think that, you know, if anything is going to happen here, it would have to be through litigation. It also, you know, is, you know, will be interesting to see the internal politics of the chamber moving forward, because they ostensibly represent, chambers of commerce ostensibly represent all business interests in the state or in the communities. And here it really seems like they sided with out-of-state organizations instead of your local in-state groups.
Right. And it was state chambers against the local chambers. The state chamber was, I mean, local chambers were for it, and the state chamber was against it.
Yeah, and it's interesting talking about the litigation factor. I mean, it's pretty clear that there is an expectation that there will be a core challenge to this. And, you know, the issues of discriminating against interstate commerce, the fact that this does impact mail order, the mail order component to getting prescription drugs, and, you know, some of the more, as you say, complex issues with ERISA laws and other things that come into play that lawmakers and the public don't care anything about but have to have some resolution on it, probably in the courts.
Yeah.
State lawmakers introduce a last-minute bill to put restrictions on the Attorney General following his $270 million settlement with Purdue Pharma. House Bill 2751 says any settlement made by him or any other future Attorney General must be paid into the general fund for lawmakers to allocate, not the Attorney General. Ryan, why do lawmakers feel they need to put this in a statute?
Well, I mean, this is really this drama that's played out ever since the Attorney General, General Hunter, made the settlement with Purdue Pharma early in the legislative session. The legislature feels like they were kept out of the loop, and maybe they were kept out of the loop. And I think that there are some interesting questions of whether or not they should have been in those conversations. I mean, who is the Attorney General's client? Is the legislature the Attorney General's client, or are the people of Oklahoma the Attorney General's client? Frankly, I think it's the people. And if you don't like what the Attorney General did here, I'm not going to say one way or the other whether they should like it or not, but if you don't, there's a way to hold the Attorney General accountable, and that's, you know, at the election, the upcoming election, at the ballot box. You can keep him or you can throw him out if you don't like the way that he did this. If you think he let the Sackler family off easy and that, you know, he made a strategic decision to get some money instead of proving a point by going to court and, you know, putting those folks on the witness stand and doing more aggressive discovery and possibly getting a bankruptcy, if you don't like that, then you can vote against him. If you like that, you can vote for it. But when we look back at things like the tobacco trust, the master settlement with the tobacco trust litigation from the late 1990s, you know, most states that had that go directly to the general revenue fund haven't seen a lot of investment in tobacco cessation programs like we've seen in Oklahoma. It was after that settlement that Attorney General Drew Edmondson made on behalf of the state of Oklahoma that the voters of Oklahoma, I think it was in 2000, came in and created a constitutional
TSET.
Here's a constitutional lockbox TSET that says this is what you can and can't do with that money. And it protected it. You know, some of it still goes to general revenue, but it said that the vast majority of it was going to go into TSET for these particular programs for a very long period of time. And so that's, you know, that was an after the fact structured way to deal with that money that was coming in. But Drew Edmondson had the authority to enter into that settlement negotiation. You know, the legislature wasn't there micromanaging it. They may have been in the room. I don't know what those dynamics were. But to put the AG in a situation where, or any AG in the country in a situation where they have to go and minute by minute get approval by the legislature or the governor to negotiate settlements with people they're suing on behalf of the people of Oklahoma, I think would be really just unworkable in the long run.
Neva.
Well, it is interesting that while not happy, the legislature and the governor clearly were not going to blow up this deal. I mean, they wanted to make a point to the Attorney General. They had the mechanism to do that by using this bill to, in essence, have clarification, as Representative O'Donnell called it. And so I think that it was their way to kind of have the final say in this long, back and forth, as you say, Ryan, of who had the right to do what, when, and were they or were they not parties that should have been advised of what was going on prior to the settlement. So I think we'll always have these issues because we're talking about politicians, we're talking about elected officials, we're talking about the whole dynamic, and then you infuse all of these attorneys and all of the other drama that goes along with it, and it also sets up for some interesting expectation of what's going to happen with the lawsuits that are still before us. I mean, that we're going to see in the court next week as they continue to pursue the suit with Johnson & Johnson and other pharmaceutical companies. So I think this is interesting. I think it was kind of the expected end from the legislative standpoint of their ability to pass something to say to General Hunter, this is kind of where we're making our stand on the issue.
Well, and it seemed to me that basically it didn't seem like they were upset about the fact that he settled or the fact that he got $270 million. I think what they were upset about is he took away their job, which was to allocate funds.
Yeah, and I think what General Hunter would say there is that that was the way that he was going to get that settlement. And, you know, that absent a very particular way that that funding would come to the state of Oklahoma, that settlement would not have come to fruition. And, you know, whether that's the case or not, I mean, I don't know. But, I mean, that's what he says. And you know, so the legislature is stuck with that. And you're right, Neva. They very clearly didn't want to blow this deal up because I think, you know, in the back of their minds, they realized, you know, this is a bird in the hand. And if we walk away from this, then we could end up with nothing, and then they would pay the political price for that. I do think that moving forward, in the back of the Attorney General's mind now, any other settlement negotiations that may happen while this trial is currently pending with the other opioid defendants, that there will be some, you know, even though the legislature hasn't officially tied his hands, I would be surprised if we see any settlements at this point that have directed or particularized appropriations of settlement dollars. I think it would be much more likely that we see something more akin to the tobacco settlement that is, mm-hmm. you know, a structured settlement over many years that would go to the general fund. And then it would be up to the legislature or the people of Oklahoma to decide if we want to lock that down somehow.
And particularly when we might be talking about, in this future instance, of billions of dollars in settlements as opposed to the number that we had in the Purdue one.
Right. Yeah.
Governor Stitt forms a task force to come up with recommendations for lawmakers to reduce the state's incarceration rate. The Criminal Justice Reentry Supervision Treatment and Opportunity Reform Task Force, also known as RESTORE, is supposed to get the suggestions completed by December 6th. Neva, does this secure Stitt's commitment to corrections reform?
Well, I think it's this ongoing struggle in the legislature, as we're talking about, of who's trying to slow down the train or who's trying to keep the process moving on a fast track. And there are bills that are hung up all the way down to the wire now that there's been this give and take on will they have the final push, will they get the votes, will they have some success. There have clearly been some successes on criminal justice reform this session. I don't think that when you look in the broad context of the forces that are really driving the reform issues, that they see this being where they wanted it to be at the end of this session. But we've been talking about this. I mean, this is progress over 20 years. I mean, we've been talking about this and making incremental, very slow movement. And clearly, there are groups out there that are still dominant and forceful and weigh in on these issues and have some real political capital to put down on the table. So we'll see what happens in the future. But these reports will be probably the blueprint for the governor to decide next session what he really wants to push, you know, really wants to push hard on in his second legislative session.
Ryan.
No, I think this is just a smokescreen. And I think that it's out of character with a governor who has shown time and again in his short time in office that if he wants to get something done, he gets it done. You know, there has never before in the history of our state been such a coalescing around a particular issue where you've brought Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives, you know, people from all across the aisle, you know, some of the smartest people in the state and around the country have invested millions of dollars over the last several years in real substantive reform efforts. And this session represented the greatest potential that we've ever seen. And, you know, Neva said we're down to the wire. As we're taping on Thursday morning, I'm getting messages from my team at the Capitol. It looks like potentially we walk out of this legislative session with no real criminal justice reform measures. I mean, Neva's right. We did get some felon voting rights restoration legislation, some licensing around mm-hmm. felon people with felony licenses. Convictions. I mean, occupational licensing. Those are important. Those are really important. But in terms of retroactivity of State Question 780, bail reform, which went down in flames yesterday, even though it polls at around 70% in the state of Oklahoma, it passed out of the Senate with Republican leadership and Democratic support. You know, this, and you know, it was a last minute move by the state sheriffs on Tuesday night to come together at the last minute and say that they were opposed to it and make up a bunch of figures about how much it was going to cost them that have no basis in reality. I mean, and lawmakers just kind of fell for it. And we saw bail reform go down. There's a potential that it could be brought back up this afternoon in the legislature. But I just got a message. Again, we're taping Thursday. I just got a message that the House may adjourn at noon today. Mm. And if that happens, retroactivity reforms to possession with intent, supervised release reforms, you know, a lot of things, you know, jury sentencing reforms that would have dramatically changed the way the criminal justice system works in the state of Oklahoma, not in a way that favors the accused, but in a way that creates a level playing field that serves everyone's interest. Whether you're a crime victim survivor or whether you're an accused of a crime, these bills all make us safer. And that we get this far in the legislative session only to watch them die with a bunch of games at the end is extremely disappointing. And I'm afraid that the announcement of this task force is giving folks political cover to feel like, well, we can just wait on this task force and not have to really do anything. And if I wish the governor would show up right now and say, put retroactivity and bail on my desk by the end of this week and I'll sign both of them. If he would do that, I think that we'd have the votes.
It will be interesting, though. We may say that the panel, this blue ribbon, this 15-member panel, won't have much significance, but as they do their work and as they come with their report at the end of the year leading into the next session, it's an election year next year. And these folks, I think if there is what will be interesting to see is, can the stakeholders involved with criminal justice reform do the job of going out to the public where there has been strong, as you say, I mean, polls indicate that that there's overwhelming support among the public. Can they then impose their wishes and make that voice, collective voice known to the lawmakers as they come back to their districts for seeking re-election, the ones that do? That could be a significant point. Can they get it done during the legislative session? It remains to be seen, and it certainly remains to be seen what's going to happen next session. But you're right, Ryan. The governor is a key player in the mix on this. I mean, if he uses political capital, he clearly has built some, has some. His favorability is still in high numbers. Among the voters in Oklahoma, so he has the opportunity to make this a centerpiece of his legislative agenda moving forward, and that's what will be interesting to watch.
Governor Stitt is still mulling over who will lead three of the five agencies over which he now has power. Stitt hasn't said yet whether he will keep the current heads of Mental Health, Health Care Authority, or Corrections. He has said he interviewed the current directors in addition to outside candidates. Ryan, what do you think is taking so long?
You know, I think that these are incredibly important jobs. I mean, you know, the governor said that he views these as CEO type positions. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're looking at multi-million dollar budgets. You're looking at employee numbers and thousands of plus, and you're looking at tens and thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Oklahomans whose lives are touched by these state agencies every single day. And so, you know, finding leadership that the governor has confidence in is important. He shouldn't rush into anything here. Now, on the other hand, we need some certainty over there. And I mean, if you're Terry White, the commissioner of the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, who has served Democratic governors, Republican governors, widely respected by folks in the community that she works in as an expert in the field, she's just sitting over there right now wondering whether or not she's got a job. And if the governor wants new leadership over there, at some point he just needs to cut bait and go, or he needs to reaffirm that Terry White is the person to be there. And I think that's the same everywhere else, that he's being deliberate, and that's understandable, but at some point you've just really got to make a decision here, because people need certainty in leadership, and there needs to be some direction at these agencies. And even where you've had, like, again, the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, Commissioner White, who's been a very well-respected leader there for years, now there's this cloud of uncertainty over, is she going to be there? And I think that can have an effect on operation and morale within an agency at some point.
Neva?
I think we're going to see, as the legislature goes home, I mean, we're going to see the governor now focus on these significant positions that he still has to fill. And he's right. When he talks about it from a business person's perspective, he looks at the Health Care Authority, Department of Corrections, the Department of Mental Health, that employ collectively those three agencies in areas more than 10,000 people. These are big jobs. And if he is taking the look at these positions and the folks that are in them and trying to determine in the composition of his total team, both at the cabinet level and in these major agency heads, then I think that taking time, being very deliberative, having multiple interviews, both with the folks that are there now and those that he may choose to take a serious look at in replacing these folks, that's part of this process. And I think the fact that he was so enmeshed in the legislative session, so involved in what was going on, so active and so out there, that it probably did slow down some of this work. But I think we'll see in the coming weeks, and we may see a rollout in the next just several days that those decisions actually have been made, and it's now time to just make them formally known to the public.
Now, there have to be Senate confirmation, and the Senate's not going to be in session. So will it be just like his cabinet, where they're in there until it comes around time for them to be confirmed?
I assume that would be the case. And, you know, I think that it's not just a matter of finding the right person. I think part of it is the governor's got to think about what he wants to do with these particular agencies. I mean, Director Albaugh, the Department of Corrections, has been a real gadfly, in the best way possible, in talking about the problems within the Department of Corrections.
Corrections reform,
yes. Yeah, I mean, he's been out there, you know, letting folks know that we are in a serious crisis, you know, from a personnel level, from an infrastructure level, from the services that we provide people that were incarcerated. He has been on the front lines. He's not been afraid. For a long time, what we've seen with state agency heads that's really bothered me is that they take these massive cuts, and then they go to the legislature and they feel almost this obligation to paint a rosy picture of like, well, we're making do. And they're really not. But I think it reaffirms, it legitimizes to the legislature the cuts that they've made, and it makes them feel okay with it. Albaugh has not done that. He has gone to the Capitol and he's like, you are putting people's lives in jeopardy by not funding the Department of Corrections. So Governor Stitt, does he want somebody like Albaugh in the Department of Corrections, or does he want somebody there that's going to, you know, just grind through and get done with what he has, or make do with what he has? I don't know. I mean, there's both personnel and a philosophical decision about these agencies that the governor's contemplating right now. But, you know, he's had some time. I expect hopefully sometime in June we've got some answers on these things.
And he's had some time to really kind of delve into the details of these agencies. I mean, he's been physically on site in many of these agencies, talked to employees, talked to the mid-management folks. I mean, he's really, I think, tried to get his own personal handle on what these folks are doing. And when you talk about agencies and making them more consumer-friendly or more willing to engage and be proactive in their roles from the public standpoint, I mean, that's a change in philosophy that is going to be pretty significant in some of these agencies, particularly when you're talking about these large agencies that, you know, no one's been successful for many, many years in getting a real handle on. So it'll be fascinating to watch over the summer if we see some real progress in these areas.
And Ryan Aneva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.